The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. Look What You Made Richard Dreyfuss Do edition. It's Wednesday, September 6th, 2017. On today's show, the Spielberg classic, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, is now 40 years old, perished in thought. We discuss its re-release. And then Taylor Swift has dropped a new song and an accompanying video, which means every pop exegete must weigh in. We invited Jody Rosen to have a no doubt docile, anodyne, completely vituperation-free conversation about the various controversies surrounding the release. And finally, we talk fanfic with Slate's own Laura Miller. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
All right. Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out in 1977, which is when I first saw it in the movie theaters. That's how old I am. I will now say, I will hereby announce, it was the single most transformative cinematic experience of my life. It returns to theaters now on its 40th anniversary as an acknowledged masterpiece. But it's hard to remember that back then, Spielberg was very young. He was a wunderkind. He had one hit to his name, and people were ready a little bit to pounce. They were ready for him to fail. Furthermore, his own friend George Lucas had come out with Star Wars that very same year. It's incredible to think. Both films are masterpieces, but they are very different from one another. Close Encounters is long, strange, hallucinogenic, and also a highly, highly personal film. It tells the story of Roy, an everyman who works for the power company, who becomes obsessed to the point of mania with the idea that aliens are visiting Earth. Why don't we listen to a clip?
Who are you people?
Monsieur Neri, s'il vous plaît, regardez bien les visages de ces gens, de ces hommes et de ces femmes. Et puis dites-moi si vous les connaissez, ou alors sont-ils des étrangers?
Strangers to you?
Yeah, except for her.
Oui, so far.
Et vous êtes cru obligé, allez-vous, de venir ici?
And the two of you felt compelled to be here?
Yeah, you might say that.
Mais qu'espériez-vous trouver?
But what did you expect to find?
An answer.
That's not crazy, is it?
Is that all you're gonna ask me? Well, I got a couple of thousand goddamn questions, you know? I want to speak to someone in charge. I want to lodge a complaint. You have no right to make people crazy. You think I investigate every Walter Cronkite story there is, huh? If this is just nerve gas, how come I know everything in such detail? I've never been here before. How come I know so much? What the hell is going on around here? Who the hell are you people?
Oh, my Lord. Dana, normally I would start with you on a movie, but Julia, I have to turn to you first. You've never seen Close Encounters before this past week?
Yep. Saw it for the first time this weekend. I thought it was great. I really liked it. I mean, it's just hard to see it without the patina of time on it and sort of thinking about it. It was hard to experience it as a pure cinematic experience and not think of where it fits into Steven Spielberg's canon and the history of blockbuster movie. You know, like I wish I could have seen it in a more pure way, I guess, if that made sense, because it's so one of the many great essays we read about it called it the most sophisticated naive movie you ever saw or something like that, some phrase like that. And it does have that Spielbergian childlike wonder, incredibly masterfully orchestrated quality to it. But I felt like I was not a sufficiently naive viewer, if that makes sense.
Well, then I think we need to go back to Steven's transformative viewing, because he was, we can presume, a somewhat more naive viewer. There was less Spielberg to know, and there was less of Steven's life to have experienced.
Was kid Steve naive? That's a Slate investigation.
So I was in, I think, seventh grade. Went with a bunch of theater nerd friends and was floored by it. It was the first time I think the capacity of a film to both visually and narratively overwhelm you really came home to me. It just seemed, even to naive Steve, it seemed to be a cinematic experience that came from someone, right? Specifically from a director. And that's just a revelation that you have at some point in your life watching a movie, that a single, you know, creative consciousness was responsible for integrating sound, light, dialogue, actors, you know, music, in order to craft a narrative that's heavily, you know, told through heavily through images. But I, you know, it's very hard for me to recover Naive Steve because I've seen the movie so many times since. And I'll tell you what, somewhat less Naive Steve is blown away by. It's just, it somehow takes the intimate form of filmmaking that Spielberg admired from Truffaut, who weirdly is in the film. You hear him in that clip. And so much of the movie is designed to honor Truffaut and what Truffaut bought in terms of intimacy and his appreciation for the perils of childhood to film, with the blockbuster as the kind of emergent and dominant form of commercial filmmaking. And to me, the only movie that's ever balanced both perfectly in a self-conscious statement about what movies can be is Close Encounters. Because in essence, the movie is about a father having a nervous breakdown, which I think was a highly personal story for Spielberg, who works out his daddy issues in many of his movies. And it's about a family losing a father to a nervous breakdown. And then that side to Spielberg about which one should have intelligent reservations then says that he's vindicated because the UFOs are real. But what Spielberg does that I think is utterly daring is he makes the domestic suburban comedy / tragedy of manners is presented as if the UFOs are not real. I mean, there's no point in the movie where you suspect they're not at all. My only point is that he is so honest about what is happening in that household, thanks to the father's obsession, that he's made an intricate movie about what would happen if you lost a parent to essentially to a nervous breakdown. And then that part of Spielberg about which we have intelligent reservations is well, how do we feel about that narrative and that tragedy being vindicated by the actual existence of aliens? And that's the Spielberg who went on to make E.T. and about which we have enormous reservations. But at that point in time, in 1977, there was a perfect equilibrium between the Spielberg who worshipped Truffaut and the Spielberg who made E.T. And that he could bring them both together in a single film, to me, is an act of total genius.
Well, I mean, I think the question that emerges seeing this 40 years later on the 40th anniversary of its release, the thing in culture that has probably changed the most is actually probably our attitudes about parenting, right? I mean, I don't remember at all as a child seeing this. I was a little bit younger than Stephen, but remember being blown away by it in theaters. And it didn't occur to me at all that it was strange that Richard Dreyfuss would leave his family at the end of the movie and just without saying goodbye or telling them what was going on, get on a spaceship and go away for who knows how long. Because some of those people who come off, right, the people that are released, by the way, this is going to be a very spoiler heavy segment, but I think
you've had 40 years.
Right. You've had time. But some of these folks that get off right before Dreyfuss gets on at the end have been on the spaceship for 30 years or something in movie time. So it may be that he's missing his children's entire childhood by making that choice. And that's something that I think maybe sticks in our cultural craw more now than it would have at the time, especially with the implicit sexism of the fact that the Melinda Dillon character, the woman whose child is abducted by aliens near the beginning and she gets him back at the end, refuses to go earlier, right? Before she gets her little boy back, she says, no, I'm not going to get on the spaceship with you, even though she's experiencing that same draw and that same obsession with getting to the mountain where they find out the spaceship will land. She's not going to go with him because she's waiting for her son. You know, so there's this inscription in the movie of the woman's job being to stay on Earth and be with her children, whereas the man can be this adventurer who goes out into the cosmos. And that made no part of my experience of the movie when I first saw it, nor did it really stick in my mind as the message or ending of the movie all of those years since. But seeing it now, after I have a child, which is worth noting Steven Spielberg did not yet when this movie was made, the end has a strange melancholy and a strange sense of both rightness. You know, you really want him to finish his story and get on that ship and go forward. And he's almost an artist, right? I mean, you identify with him as this person who's driven by some vision he doesn't understand to achieve something higher. And the final scene of the movie, the ascent of the spaceship, very much vindicates that movement of that character. But the people that are left on Earth, right, including us, are sort of left to wonder, well, what about us?
All right. No, absolutely. I think this is a movie as much about a bit parental abandonment and the hopelessness of the human condition, because we, in fact, aren't going to have this angelic-like intercession in human affairs. It's a profoundly depressing movie, too. But I just want to say, Julia, before we go to you, it needs to be said that this is visual storytelling on par with I believe any movie ever made. It competes with anything Ford, Kurosawa, Renoir, Méliès made. Its politics aside, his capacity as a visual storyteller, which were, you know, kind of previewed in Jaws, itself a genre masterpiece. I mean, he never surpassed them in this movie, and no one ever surpassed them. That's my, I don't know. That's just my estimation of it as a film.
Yeah, I mean, it's astonishing how much command Spielberg has in just thrusting these incredibly intense and diverse scenes and landscapes at you. Like, you feel emotionally piloted along in this beautiful way. But, one other reason, Dana, why the family narrative might not have stuck with you in the initial version you saw is that the initial theatrical release included a significantly curtailed version of that story. You basically don't spend hardly any time with his family, as far as I understand it, in that version, and you get pretty quickly to him pursuing his vision and the potential of contact with aliens. And Steven Spielberg released an expanded version in 1980, and it's that expanded version that's been re-released now, where you spend a lot more time with Terry Garr, who plays his wife and his kids, and sort of what happens in their community as he begins to fall prey to this mania. The thing that I think is most admirable about it, and that for me maybe makes it more powerful than other Spielberg pieces, is that dissonance or that denial of the like happy family reunion at the end of it makes it just so much more interesting. I mean, it seems like it is simultaneously a movie about the like transcendent power of belief and a movie about mental illness at the same time.
Yeah.
Like what it's like to be married to a crazy person. And they're both right. Like Terry Garr is right to be dismayed that her husband has turned into like a mashed potato smearing weirdo who's lost all capacity to pay attention to the particulars of their existence. And also Richard Dreyfuss's character is right to pursue his contact with the divine. Like that, like the movie contains both of those things within it, and neither outweighs the other. And that's what seemed most astonishing.
All right. Well, you guys have both said such incredibly beautiful, insightful things about my favorite movie that I now have to call in a ringer for my concluding comments. Who's going to be the Godhead himself, the man who I think in some ways more than anybody invented the idea of the director as a kind of literary author. Jean Renoir went and saw Close Encounters in Beverly Hills, and he immediately wrote Truffaut a letter. He said, "We have finally seen Close Encounters. It is a very good film, and I regret it was not made in France. This type of popular science would be most appropriate for the compatriots of Jules Verne and Méliès. You are excellent in it because you are not quite real. There is more than a grain of eccentricity in this adventure. The author..." Speaking of Spielberg now, and for a French director, for Jean Renoir to call an American blockbuster director an author, he says to Truffaut, and to say it to François Truffaut, he says, "The author is a poet. In the south of France, one would say he is a bit fada. He brings to mind the exact meaning of this word in Provence. The village fada is the one possessed by the fairies." That just goes down as my favorite. Probably my favorite movie of all time. All right, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's 40, which means I'm a million years old. Go see it.
Oh, and P.S., see it in Dolby if you possibly can. I did, and it was so crisp and beautiful and sounded amazing.
We'd love to hear what you think about it at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast we talk about business. Julia Turner, what do we have?
The business. First, our live show in Toronto on September 13th at the Toronto Reference Library is sold out, but there is still one way to get into the show. We're doing a special after party with cocktails, and if you buy a ticket to that, it also guarantees admission to the show. There are only a few tickets left for the after party, so for more information, check slate.com/live. I also want to take a moment here to recommend that our listeners check out The Gist. If you are a podcast fan, and come on, you probably are since you're listening to this, Mike Pesca has been hosting an excellent daily news podcast for Slate for 3+ years. And if you like your daily news in audio format, you should definitely subscribe and listen to The Gist. Mike Pesca is just like a singular brain and tongue.
He's so trying so hard to disguise himself as a guy, and he does a great job of it because he can talk about sports, and he kind of has this, it's like the presentation is bluster, but underneath is like,
Socrates or something. I mean, it's just an incredible blend of qualities.
That's The Gist with Mike Pesca. Also in our Slate Plus segment today, we'll be talking to the great Jody Rosen, wonderful critic and frequent guest to this show, about the book he's working on about the bicycle. We've made it a custom on this show to grill hosts and guests by asking five questions about the book they are working on. And we will ask Jody five questions and he will reveal various answers. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program where fans of Slate and our podcasts help support us. If you enjoy this podcast and find it valuable, joining Slate Plus is a great way to support the work that we do. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing these shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other great benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. All right, what is next?
All right, well, Taylor Swift, the pop star, maybe you've heard of her, has dropped a new single. It's called Look What You Made Me Do. This meant one thing to this program. We had to get on the phone to our EFOP extreme friend of the program, Jody Rosen, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Jody, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Stephen.
I believe what is about to follow is a discussion about the nature of criticism. But that said, I think what we should begin by doing before we get to the essay in New York Magazine about which we'll start to scream momentarily, let's listen to a clip. Isn't cool. No, I don't like you. But I got smarter, I got harder in the nick of time. Honey, I rose up from the dead, I do it all the time. I got a list of names and yours is in red underline. I check it once, then I check it twice. Oh! Ooh, look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me. Ooh, look what you made me do. All right, well, let's get now to the heart of the matter here, which is Mark Harris, a critic that I think everybody around this table admires enormously, wrote a piece for New York Magazine, and he begins by talking about a series of incredibly depressing pop culture, sports culture nadirs, including the Floyd Mayweather, Conor McGregor fight, Bachelor in Paradise. And then he gets to the heart of it. He says, he writes, just as we reach the final dregs and leftovers phase of the summer, the first undeniable piece of pop art of the Trump era landed right in our laps. He then goes on to say, I have no idea what Swift's politics are, but I've heard enough of her songs over the years so that of course I know what her politics are. I win, but for the record, I'm the victim of haters and losers. Jody, you'll forgive me for saying this piece appears to have gone straight up your nose because you took to Twitter and Facebook and wrote quite a lot about it in response. What was it about this argument that you thought was wrongheaded?
The first thing was simply that it struck me. Mark Harris, as you said, is a guy I respect enormously, really, really a lot. But in this case, the biggest thing was the failure to actually address the song qua song at all. It's not that music and this song in particular can't express politics. It's that how is the politics that is being imputed to it expressed in the sound of the song, in the production, in the harmonic language, in the vocal performance. When I listened to those things, I drew the conclusion this song is kind of an elaborate jape and not some strident, exercise in score settling that failure to grasp the song's humor struck me as particularly problematic. I mean, we can get into my other qualms with the piece, of which there are many, but that was like my first and reaction, which is like, let's talk about the song. Let's not just, it seemed to me that for a guy who claimed in this piece to disdain the hothouse atmosphere of social media, he had just shoveled in a whole lot of hot takes of Taylor Swift, not really based on either this song or any familiarity that he demonstrated with her music and what she's about as like a songwriter and performer. You know, Harris says that Taylor Swift's, that the message of all her songs or her art is, I'm the winner, you're all losers, but I'm the victim. I just don't, that's not the message I get from her music. She does not play the victim in songs, as that's not really what her songs are about. She writes love songs. She writes breakup songs. She writes songs about self-assertion. I mean, she may have played the victim in various imbroglio internet cause celeb, but in her music, she hasn't really. And I don't, so I think that like the inference that's being drawn there is about stuff external to her music. And I think that's a problem.
But Jody, one thing I would say in response is that all criticism since the beginning of time has made the sort of analogy from specific works, you know, synecdotally out to the cultural moment. And if you were to take that away from critics as one possible way of interpreting a culture, especially pop culture, we'd be left with almost nothing. I mean, we'd be left with kind of a vacuous formalism. I would break the complaint that Harris is making against her down maybe into two separate parts. The first is that she's winning and complaining about it incessantly. I don't, as a factual claim, I don't really know whether that's true. As an aesthetic claim, is she ironic in this song? I mean, many people think maybe yes, but then she overplays that in the coda, which we should talk about. But to me, the real essence of the complaint is that pop culture seems to be manufacturing itself within its own rather hermetically sealed vacuum, a complaint that Harris, you know, levels against her, pretty explicitly. I just think that's an argument really that Pomo irony isn't going to rescue in a sense. This song is so about the images that have been imputed to this person and behaviors that have been imputed to this person that it's a little too sterile and echoey for me to relate to on any level.
And I would agree with you. And that's a criticism that I totally accept. I mean, when I learned that Taylor Swift's album was going to be called Reputation, and I saw the album cover, which has images of Taylor Swift's face with newspaper copy superimposed over it.
Which contains nothing but the words Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I groaned because I agree that it is hermetically sealed. And to me, it's a boring subject for music. And so I think that this song itself is okay as an exercise in that particular subject matter, but it's not it to me. It is claustrophobic and it doesn't interest me very much, but that's not the criticism that Mark Harris is making here. So I think we need to kind of invoke Godwin's law when he's calling her Trumpian. I mean, it's really an extreme complaint. And this is where I think, if you want to talk about the politics of criticism, there's something to be said here about the current moment, because what I think we're seeing in this brouhaha is, the power of so-called stan culture. If you are familiar with the term, you know, it's a portmanteau mm-hmm. word. It's a portmanteau of stalker and fan.
I never knew that was the derivation of the word
well,
stan.
Well, the other derivation is it comes from the Eminem song Stan, which is about an obsessive fan. The point is that, like, you know, Taylor Swift's fans, Beyonce's Bayhive or however the fuck you pronounce that, Lady Gaga's Little Monsters, you know, all these fan armies construe pop music fandom, pop music appreciation, you might even say, is this kind of zero-sum game battle of pop stars for supremacy. And that extreme form of fandom, which has its own shrill politics that are incubated in the hothouse of social media, is now seeping into criticism and journalism. And that, to me, is very grim. And it's not just, of course, that the stans are saying, I think Beyonce's music's I love Beyonce's music, or even that they're saying, I think Beyonce's music's the best and everybody else's music sucks. It's that they're, you know, conferring the status of sainthood on like the star that they like and imputing like moral treachery to everybody else. And that is, you know, and then to get Trumpian about it, what springs up as a result is all kinds of fake news. So such that we've seen in the last week stories about Taylor Swift being like a neo-Nazi and an alt-right sympathizer. And that, I think, is what is the kind of larger takeaway from this for criticism, is that, you know, in the media ecosystem that we're in, where everybody has to churn out copy about Taylor Swift really quickly, there's a lot of, and everyone's obsessing over Trump. There's maybe some blithe connections that are being drawn between one thing and the other here.
I guess I would try to play Steve here, split the baby in half, in that I do think you could argue that this song it makes sense that the song came out in 2017 instead of in 2006 or, God help us, 2026. I hope Trump's not still president then, without necessarily equating it with Trump. Like the notion of saying this is a piece of culture that it's worth looking at in the context of this particular moment, and then saying like Taylor is Trump. Those are two different points that Harris makes in the piece. And I think there's a clearer case for the first one than the second, which is even if you argue that she's playing with these ideas and she's messing around with them, the notion that we're inhabiting a world both politically and culturally where the internet facilitates the lobbying back and forth of bad faith insults, and that you could create both the terrifying political figure that is Trump and like the set of stuff that the songwriter Taylor Swift is playing with. Like that seems like one way to say this is a song of the Trump era without saying like she's a craven monster.
Yeah, I think differentiating those two points is an important thing to do. The night that Mark Harris's piece posted, I posted a link to it on Twitter because I just thought it was a fascinating piece of criticism. I hadn't even heard the song at that point. And I could not believe the amount, the vectors of hate that stirred up immediately on Twitter, where total strangers were sending me things like, oh, thanks, white person that no one cares about. It was very racialized, for one thing.
Right. And like, I mean, to be fair, I think like, you know, it's no accident that there's a lot of racialized conversation around this. Conversation is maybe a nice way of putting it. And there are interesting things to be said about Taylor Swift's image, about the role that race has played in the various controversies that have surrounded her. Obviously, like the Kanye West Taylor Swift controversy, which we will, I like, they'll be rolling me out of bed and like wheeling me in here on a gurney when I'm 85 to discuss that, right? But I mean, that resonates with a lot of interesting tropes in the culture, and you know, the legitimate grievances of African Americans about images in popular culture. All that said, it's, yeah, I just think we need to pull these apart, and I think it's at this moment, it strikes me that at this moment, yes, we can discuss ways in which, you know, ideas are in the culture that are seemingly Trumpian are expressing themselves in pop culture. But like to talk about Taylor Swift, like how did she vote? I don't know what her politics is, but her what did he say? Her music is Trumpian. That's a pretty serious charge when you think about who Trump is and what he represents. And
no, that's true.
And it seems like if the role of a critic is to look at a piece of art or culture and tease out the things that are interesting and resonant about it, that to me seems an extremely ham-fisted way. I mean, that to me is the very definition of a hot take. And it seems like it's beneath Mark Harris, and it's like, it's just a boring way to discuss Taylor Swift, whatever you think of her music, it's just like Trumpian, you know what I mean? And I just want to say one other thing. So my other complaint about Mark Harris's piece in particular was, okay, he didn't really discuss the music itself. He toggled straight to like Taylor Swift is a pop victimologist. You know, she plays the victim in all these various ways. He didn't really get into it. He just sort of asserted it. But in any case, if you're going to discuss Taylor Swift's victimhood, it's worth invoking the fact that she just was found in a court of law to have been the victim of sexual assault. And the way that she handled that case, I think, is instructive. She didn't litigate it online and social media. She didn't talk to the press about it. She didn't even talk about it in her music heretofore. She went into court and in a manner very similar to the way that she, the persona in some of her songs, she, you know, asserted this is some fucking bullshit. And she was found in a court to have been, you know, right. She was the victim of sexual assault. And there was a specious lawsuit brought against her. And so to then call her Trumpian when you have like a confessed sex assaulter in the White House and you have a woman who a court just declared a victim of sexual assault, that seems to me like a little clueless.
Well, let me defend the Harris piece and a kind of criticism that I really believe in. First of all, I think it has to be done somewhat agnostically, because what you're saying is, how are we one day going to look back on this current moment? You're doing this kind of a little bit of a, you know, hocus pocus where you're projecting imaginatively into a future that is looking back on 2017. But one of the ways you get away with doing that, I think, is that we all the time look back on the 1950s or the Reagan era. I mean, pick whatever chronological unit you want to impose on the past, and you find likenesses that were less obvious at the time. And you know, of course, there's a shallow zeitgeist version of this that's badly done. But there is a way in which many facets of culture in the, you know, Reagan era, which, Jody, as you know, I'm writing a book about, I mean, the expressed Reaganism and expressed a kind of shift in the culture that were not overtly political, but in some ways were finally culpable. They went with a prevailing energy that was toxic rather than against it. And I think it's not only possible, but a political obligation on the part of the critic to ask about the present moment with the degree of salutary agnosticism, because we don't really know, you know, is this person swimming with against the tide? Is the tide a healthy or a toxic one? What energies are mutually reinforcing to one another? Who is drawing courage from certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of songs or movies? And who is it putting on the defensive and why? A critic gets, you know, paid the huge money to, you know, be a critic because you can't finally be right about it. You're not identifying a color or adding two numbers. You're not doing something empirical. You're making an argument. And his piece was an essay in the true sense of the word. He himself invokes it. He says, you look back on the Reagan era and you see Top Gun and Dynasty. And sure, there was probably someone at the time who said quite rightly about Top Gun that it's a kitsch fiesta and you shouldn't take it too seriously. But on the other hand, looking back on it, there absolutely is every reason to believe that that movie enabled a kind of shallow jingoism and what turned out to be, I think, a historically terrible presidency. And maybe it deserves to be held accountable. And I don't think it's out of bounds to make that move about something that came out last month.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I accept that for sure. I mean, I guess the one other thing I would say, I mean, you know, someone like Taylor Swift, like you could look at her in all sorts of ways. You could look at her as some sort of, I mean, Steve, you could look at her as like a neoliberal pop icon, right? For various ways that I won't, you know, I won't elaborate here. Like, you know, you could look at her as like, you know, a 1% of the 1% icon. On the other hand, if you want to historicize it, she's also a female singer-songwriter with an audience that is disproportionately young women who they are not taking the message that Mark Harris is taking from her. And I think that's important. If you've gone to see Taylor Swift in concert and seen her connection with her fans, who, by the way, run the gamut of race and ethnicity and are largely, but not exclusively, by the way, female, that's some real shit, their connection there. So for, you know, I don't want to jump in. I don't want to be the identity politics demagogue either, but especially when you think about the history of the way popular music has been interpreted by critics, you know, women in the audience who've disproportionately made up the audience for pop music throughout history, and female performers have kind of gotten the shaft. Okay, and Taylor Swift is a complicated figure, singer songwriter auteur, businesswoman who's doing her own shit and isn't taking any shit at all in her songs. You know, is she just a feminist? Is she you know, some entitled rich girl? Maybe she's both and more. So that to me is like something you got to bring into the argument too.
Yeah. Well, in addition to the kind of racial cluelessness that she may have exhibited in the past in her various conflicts and imbroglios, I think there's also just the, you know, fundamental cluelessness of this song that comes out where she's like rapping badly and adopting a traditionally black mode of pop music and focusing entirely on herself and her stupid celebrity beefs, even if in a joking way, at a moment where like that's just not what's happening in this country right now or in this place. And as you say, Jody, maybe she wrote this in the waning days of the Obama era when we all thought this was going to come out I don't think we actually know, but she seems out to lunch racially. And I think the other argument people have made is we don't know how she voted. She does command the loyalty of this teen fan army. She never, during the election, said anything explicit of like, hey, teen fan army, if you care about the fate of women, perhaps you should consider the stakes in this election and vote accordingly. So those are among the political and racial marks against her. I think she may prove to be an artist very much of the same era that created Trump, and that there may be a really fascinating and intellectually rigorous and sound way to make that argument. I think we got to let her make a few more albums and see how capacious her talent proves. But to me, that seems like a risk factor on the horizon more than this specific song means she is Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the hot takedown. And I think actually, Jody, congratulations. I think you've kind of converted me. I mean, when I read that Mark Harris piece, I was impressed by his craft as a writer and by the breadth of things he was bringing in and just by how, as I say, how accurately he summarized the moment. But I think that the final conclusion that he came to really is kind of wrong, whatever you think about Taylor Swift herself. I think it's too fast. The equivalency is too sudden.
I like the piece more than ever. I mean, I think one function of a critic writing on a weekly deadline for a weekly magazine is to make the take hot and throw it out there and, you know, kind of let everyone live and die on it until they move on. I mean, it's just, you know, he's not Edmund Wilson writing to the Finland Station. I mean, this is, you know, he can be that critic. He works in that mode too, but this was just, this was throwing it out there. And anyway, the amazing thing is it stimulated a conversation in which we were about Taylor Swift, about which we were all mutually respectful. Am I wrong?
this is progress, guys. This is how we're going to fight the Trump era.
Everybody fell asleep listening to this segment, by the way.
I was going
to
say, there are three people still listening. all right. Jody Rosen, contributing writer to the Times Magazine. Will you sort of hang around while we do another segment and then join us for the Plus segment?
Would love to.
All right. Fantastic. Fanfic or fan fiction can be variously defined to encompass almost anything from Virgil's Aeneid to hot Spock on Kirk action. Here's a somewhat narrow academic definition. Someone has called it creative material featuring characters from works whose copyright is held by others. Under that definition, and maybe a slightly more imaginative one, you can see how this would be a renaissance. The age of Harry Potter and Buffy and the internet altogether would make for a renaissance of fan fiction. Here to discuss the phenomenon is Laura Miller, books and culture columnist for Slate. Laura, welcome back to the show. You are an EFOP. You're an extreme friend of the program now. I'd like to let you know you've won your latest epaulette.
Well, I'm honored.
I want to start with something that you said in a piece that you wrote a couple years ago about fanfic that really surprised me, which is that the author Annie Proulx, who's probably best known for having written the short story Brokeback Mountain, from which came the movie, wishes she'd never written it.
Well, I don't know how serious she is about saying she wishes she never wrote Brokeback Mountain, but she was very aggravated and frustrated and exasperated by a group of fans, I think, who originally found out about the story through the film, who really objected to its sort of sad and tragic ending, and who kept writing their own versions of the story with a happier ending and then sending them to her, which I think was their big mistake. She was like, no, that's not how it ends, understandably. And it was just a strange and alien experience to her, because she, being a literary fiction writer, is not very familiar with the sort of world and impulse known as fic, and it made no sense to her. But it's actually an incredibly common practice and a huge subculture that has gone on to spawn all different kinds of original works based, that started out as fan fiction.
I know very little about fanfic, but it seemed to me there are two or three different ways to look at it. There's a kind of cultural capital argument that it's good because it's democratic, right? There's a therapeutic argument that it allows people to enact forbidden desires creatively. And then there's just an aesthetic argument that it's getting at least good enough to compete with the, you know, original work. So, for example, 50 Shades of Grey, whatever one thinks about it, was derivative of Twilight, was fanfic of Twilight. Where do you come out on some of these arguments?
Well, I find the whole world of fan fiction completely fascinating. Although I'm always saying to my contacts within that world that I don't have that particular fanish inclination. I am happy with canon. One of the things that I like about canon, which is what fan fiction writers, the term they use for the original, the source material, what could be the copyrighted material or just the original material. What I like about it is that it's limited. And for me, thinking about what it means within the limitations of what the original creator wanted to do with it is a rewarding practice in itself. But that's because I'm a critic. Fic writers, and that's what they often like to be called, or they like to have fan fiction called fic. That's the common term used. They look at an existing story and they see all the things that they wish were there that aren't there. And then they set about creating those things. And I think it's certain types of work tend to inspire that impulse more than others. And to me, it's kind of lovely and fascinating example of human creativity. Some of it is good. Some of it is bad. I'm not that interested in reading variants of a tale that I really like. It never would have occurred to me to write fic about any of the books or movies or television shows I've loved over my life. I just do not have that urge. But the people who do fascinate me, and the world in particular that they've built out of that practice and the community that they've assembled and the customs and the language that they've developed to talk about it are eternally fascinating to me.
The dynamics of it are incredibly interesting. I mean, I similarly, you know, I don't care to create fiction of any kind, literary or derivative. but the essential occasion for our conversation is a new book out by Francesca Coppa called The Fan Fiction Reader, which is one of the first times, I think, that there's been a published anthology of fic. In part because of the copyright troubles around publishing anything that's based off of copyrighted works. But again, the aesthetics of the underlying stuff aren't as interesting as the economy that surrounds it to me. I mean, one question I have for you, Laura, is to what degree is the rise of fic, I mean, it's somewhat attributable to the internet and the networking of fans probably, but it also seems like it finds a home particularly in serialized works, so that it seems like it would thrive in an age where television is a dominant medium rather than movies, and also in an age where just IP, like the corporations that own IP, like to franchise them and make there be more of whatever it was that was successful. But like, you have the sense, if you watched Buffy and are aware that there's a show Angel, that like there is a whole universe in which you could turn Cordelia into whatever you want and make a whole story around her. Or, you know, J.K. Rowling encourages this with her various iterations on the Harry Potter universe. And, you know, the notion that this is a thing that young devout readers do, and it's a way that devout readers become writers of varying qualities and aspiration levels, is super interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that the works that lend themselves best, or that are sort of spark that thick flame of creativity the most, tend to be ones that create a world. So probably the version of modern fandom were the Sherlock Holmes stories. And it's not usually seen as like a fan fiction sector, but because so many of the people who wrote the fan fiction off of Sherlock Holmes were men, and the culture of fan fiction in our contemporary period, which begins with Star Trek, is largely driven by women. But there was a whole group of people who met regularly, who wrote spin-off Sherlock Holmes stories, or who wrote mock historical treatises about what happened to the characters in between the stories. But there are these gaps. It creates a world, but then there are these gaps in it. And the impulse is to sort of fill in those gaps or change things in a certain way. And so I have no idea if there was Dickens fan fiction. I'm not aware of it. I do know that very famously Thackeray strongly objected to the ending of Ivanhoe, the romantic pairing, and rewrote wrote his own version of it that ended the way that he liked. So, you know, it's an impulse that's pre-existed all of you know, television and film. But I think that television and film bring these, or television in particular, brings these expansive narratives that feel like they could, like, as you said, expand forever or go off in this direction or go off in that direction. They encourage the idea that the world of the story could be made larger or there's some corner of it that could be explored, and then brought that into so many households where people maybe didn't grow up with reading long serialized novels or even thinking of themselves as writers. And then that those stories kind of got into their heads and they wanted it to be another way and they just had to make that thing. And that's what I think probably television brought those kinds of stories into more lives and created, and then the internet created the opportunity to share that with a lot of other people. And then the other really unusual thing about fan fiction is that it's a kind of a communal process. You post your story and then you try to get people to read it and give you responses, and people rewrite according to responses, or they write original pieces on certain cues. You know, there are things like writing exercises where, like, write a Christmas story about, you know, Buffy or whatever, or write a story where this happens or that happens. And they present each other with challenges. And so it's almost, it has some of the qualities of a folk culture in that way. There's this shared body of stories, and then people, you know, compete or they offer additions to each other, and then they take them or they use something else. And it's a very collaborative form, really different from like our idea of the writer as somebody who's like off alone, this solitary genius figure.
Yeah. And actually off of that, one thing that Stephen Burt pointed out in his New Yorker piece about this new anthology is that part of what fan fiction offers to starting writers is an immediate audience. So if you're just alone in your basement scribbling away on your story that does not have a popular IP as its main characters, then nobody's going to read that story. Or it's much harder to find a community of people to read and respond to and give you feedback and all the things that you might learn from as a writer on that story. Whereas if you, you know, write about an alternate version of Twilight where Bella falls in love with Harry Styles, you can probably find a community of people to give you a bunch of feedback on that, which is in its own interesting dynamic.
All fiction has a kind of ramp up where you start out not caring about it, not believing in it, and then it's the job of the creator to get you interested, to make you care about the characters, to start to wonder what happens next. And you don't have to go through that ramp up if you're taking characters that are already known. Yeah.
But sparing the readers the work of that ramp up is also putting an extra burden on the writer, in a sense, you have to bring something new to the work. And it seems like from some of the reading we were doing about this new fic anthology and other places where it occurs, is it the dangerous path the fic writer can go down is to sort of insert him or herself into the story too obviously, to make this kind of proxy character, sometimes called the Mary Sue character, right? This sort of flawless hero or heroine who gets inserted into the story. I think this was you cited one story, a Trekkie story, where a woman gets on the Starship Enterprise and everyone falls in love with her.
Well, that's the original Mary Sue story where that character was called Mary Sue and was where that term comes from. Yeah, but I also find that the critical language that fan fiction communities have come up with for things that are good or bad about their works actually apply pretty universally to all forms of art. And the first time I heard of the Mary Sue, I was like, oh my God, that describes exactly a certain thing that I often encounter in literary fiction. The idealized character that's, you know, the character that's based on the author, but lives in a slightly better neighborhood and has a better car and is younger and good looking. I mean, thrillers written by middle-aged men have these middle-aged male main characters who are really,
Sam.
Really Marty Stew is what they're sometimes called. They're in really good shape and they're, you know, so attractive to women and, you know, they just don't have any.
They can decode medieval runes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what is that character, that Dan Brown character, if not a Marty Stew? So I love that this world of fiction making has come up with this whole vocabulary to talk about things that are actually universal problems of fiction and happen, you know, sins committed by all kinds of creators in a way that feels fresh and new. And in a way, because I respond like a critic does rather than like a fic writer does to works of art that I like, the thing that excites me the most about fan fiction is the way that the people who make it and who contribute to the making of it talk about it, because they have developed an understanding of how stories work that's really sophisticated and astute. Now, a lot of the people who write a classic Mary Sue story are really young and just starting out, and I'm sure so many writers have the story of like that first story of the rocket to Mars that they wrote when they were in seventh grade or something. And I'm sure it has a square-jawed hero who is good at everything. It's just what people do when they're starting out.
My favorite critical term from the fic community, which I think we've discussed on the show before, is shipping, right?
Yeah.
Which is yearning for two characters in a show or work to get together, and the fic sometimes takes the form of causing that union to take place. That is a thing that has been in literature forever, wanting people to do it, but that didn't have a good critical name.
And that was basically William Thackeray's issue with Ivanhoe, is that he wanted Ivanhoe to be with Rowena instead of whoever it was he was with.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry.
if we've revoked the spoiler alert on Close Encounters, I think also we revoke it on Ivanhoe.
It's not like anybody's going to go out and read Ivanhoe, so I don't think we need to worry about that.
Maybe not. Laura Miller, it is just a total pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks for coming on to talk about fanfic.
It's been fun. Thanks.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Yes. Let's see. So last week, I reviewed a movie for Slate called Columbus, which was the feature film of a director who goes by a pseudonym, a one-name pseudonym, Koganada. He's a Nashville, Tennessee-based video artist and video essayist who got a chance to make his first feature film. So Columbus isn't quite the endorsement, although I loved it, and I do recommend you see it. It's a beautiful, small movie with John Cho of Harold and Kumar fame in a straight role, and it's sort of about architecture in a really fascinating way. Anyway, you can read my review, and if you get a chance to see Columbus, see it. But that's not my endorsement. My endorsement is actually to go to the Vimeo website of this director, Koganada, and just look at his past work. He has an archive there of all the video essays he's created through the years, some of which reside on the Criterion website or on the British Film Institute website. In other words, he's done work, commissioned work for people, but he's also just made these little beautiful jewel-like video essays about things he's interested in, usually cinema. So two starters that I wanted to recommend, because there's a few dozen to choose from there, are one called Bergman's Mirrors that is nothing but a kind of supercut of all the women looking into mirrors in Ingmar Bergman movies, edited together really beautifully and accompanied by someone reading Sylvia Plath's poem, which I believe is called The Mirror, a poem about mirrors. Perfect little maybe 3 to 4 minute video. And there's also a slightly more maybe discursive one, critical sort of one, about Richard Linklater that's called On Cinema and Time, that looks at how Richard Linklater's movies explore time, which, given the fact that he has so many movies in which, or series of movies in which you watch people age through time, is a really beautiful way to approach Linklater. So yes, we'll put the link on our show page, but go to Koganada's Vimeo site and explore his work and see if you don't get excited about his beginning film career.
Wonderful. Julia, what do you have?
I have an appropriate first week of September endorsement, which is a discovery I've made in our Summer Strut list. So true to form, I have been listening to an edit of our Summer Strut playlist all summer long. I kind of transmogrified it into a playlist called Kid Drive and added all of our kids' favorite songs to it. So it's like a mix of Summer Strut and then You're Welcome from Moana and 76 Trombones and the museum song from P.T. Barnum.
Oh my God, I need a Spotify link immediately.
It's like kind of a great mashup list, if I do say so myself. But one sleeper gem from the Summer Strut list, which I should stipulate is not strutty at all, but is like lovely and whatever the opposite of melancholic is, elegiac maybe. That's not the opposite, but
like exultant or something like that.
Well, it's. Let me say what the song is, and then I'll explain I'll try and triangulate amongst all the adjectives we've thrown out. The song is called "Days Like This." It's a song by Van Morrison, which is an artist band. I don't even know. Like, not an artist I've paid any attention to ever.
You don't know whether Van Morrison is a person or a group?
No. It's an individual or a band?
I don't.
Oh, my God.
All I know about Van Morrison is Brown Eyed Girl.
I love the Neil Youngs.
I wasn't born yet, people. Anyway, it's an artist. It's a guy.
He is a man.
Anyway.
He's a person.
Like I said, this is what I love about Summer Stratt. I discover things that I did not know. The song "Days Like This" by Van Morrison, the man, is excellent. And what I mean by the opposite of melancholic is it is kind of sleepy and slow and backward looking, reminiscent. But it is also about the possibility of contentment and joy. And it's beautiful. So listen to it and check out all of my favorite band, Van Morrison's cool tracks. No, I take it back. I can only endorse this track, but I endorse it heartily. All right, Steve.
Oh, my God. All right. we lost two really good ones this past week. Steely Dan's co-founder, co-writer of most, if not all, of their music, Walter Becker, died at the age of 67. Becker was a great musician and a great songwriter. I think the Dan is one of the most underrated bands of all time. They're mistaken for not being cool. That's ridiculous. They're just incredible musicians, incredible songwriters. So many of their, I just love, like, Bad Sneakers, great song. Deacon Blues, one of the best pop songs ever written. The entire album of Asia, Home at Last, wonderful songs. People don't know him well enough. Couple of other things about Walter Becker you might not know. The first is that he produced a kind of pet favorite album of mine, a sentimental favorite of mine. He produced the album Blind Cowboys by Ricky Lee Jones in 1989, and I wore that album out that year and for a couple subsequent years. And he also has one of the great rock star websites was Becker's own, and it was very much his own. There's a ton of his own writing on it that's very mordant and observational about his status in the music world. It's really, really, really good. Becker was a huge talent, and this was too soon. I never understood John Ashbery's work until I saw him read in the flesh, probably right around the time that I was listening to Ricky Lee Jones, right around 1990. He came to UVA and read his poems, and I understood at last how funny they were, how precise, and how weird, but mostly how funny they were and how funny he was and how he had intended them. They weren't meant as this postmodernist wallpaper. They were poignant and to use your word, Julia, quite melancholy. So my endorsement is not just Ashbery, who, of course, is one of the towering geniuses of the second half of the 20th century, on and on and on, but to go to YouTube and watch him read. He read at the Kelly Writers House, so very good friends of mine, about 4 years ago. Quite on in years when he did that, but there's archival footage of him going back many decades. If you are interested in getting to know John Ashbery, one possible place to start is with video.
I mean, I don't know his work well, but people were posting some amazing poems by him all weekend. I was so into him, it made me want to read him. I don't know. He's so prolific. I kind of don't know where to start. And he has, like, long narrative things. And, like, if you just wanted to crack one book that wasn't some huge, epic, overwhelming thing, what would you read?
The place I would start is where he started. The Tennis Court Oath, I believe, was his first collection, 1962. Anyway, it's probably the most accessible way into him, and then from there, there are dozens. I mean, he did so much, but start there, and then maybe move on to the video, and you'll find your way. Okay, so John Ashbery and Walter Becker. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Networks. It's him, actually, that steps off of the spaceship at the end of Close Encounters. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out our entire roster at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'd be days like this. When you don't need to worry, there'll be days.